Welcome to Finding Your Identity, the podcast about helping you find your identity. Welcome back to Finding Your Identity. This is episode 18, and I'm your host, Derek McKinney, and I'm going to take you on a fun and wild ride of randomness and unknown identities. And this is like the antithesis of finding your identity, or the frustration that comes from not being able to find an identity, or, you know, just some fun facts that I'm going to just kind of spit out here, because I was thinking that it's kind of an interesting idea to talk about people who we don't know who they are necessarily, or they've been, you know, deemed as kind of forgotten from history and from society, but yet what they did may have, you know, created a lasting impact on society and in this world, because they are remembered in their unknown forms. So that's what this episode is going to be about. And it's going to be some interesting information, things you maybe have heard about before, or maybe didn't know a lot about. And I'm going to cover them with a little bit of detail, but it should be a fun, somewhat light-hearted episode. Although there is a little bit of morbidity to a couple of them, just by the nature of they are being unknown and their identities are unknown, because they unfortunately, you know, passed before their time and were not able to be identified necessarily. And so there's that little warning that I want to throw out there, that little disclaimer that, you know, this may not be intended for all audiences. So starting probably with one of the lighter ones, and I think, you know, maybe a lot of people know about this one, and it's somewhat a famous one in history, but they call it the VJ Day Sailor. There was, you know, a famous painting, famous picture, I should say, that was hung in, I think it was in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I believe it was in, it was actually featured as a painting, which I don't know if it was necessarily in this museum, but in the Night at the Museum movies, it was featured as a painting in which one of the characters disappeared into, because, you know, the museum came to life at night. Sorry if I might have spoiled that movie for you, but the, you know, Night at the Museum, there, this famous painting. And what it is it's a famous painting of this sailor who had grabbed a nurse and kind of leaned her back to kiss her in a celebratory kiss, because, it, you know, all the sailors were coming home from the war, and it was, you know, after the victory with, you know, over Japan in World War II, and it was a time to celebrate, you know, because all the soldiers were coming home. And I believe this was in New York City. Yes, it was in Times Square. That's right. And this, you know, random picture was kind of snapped in it. And I think it gained in popularity throughout the years, but, you know, it's known as a famous snapshot in time of, you know, the end of the Great War, the Second Great War, and it's a famous picture, and nobody knows who the two people were in it. There's speculations, there's some people who came forward, but nothing was ever corroborated. There was no conclusions that proved that anybody who came forward was the actual participant in either side, the sailor or the female nurse, that were, you know, participating in that celebratory kiss. So that one's kind of an interesting unknown, and, you know, these two identities are unknown. And if you actually look up the VJ Day Sailor, and you look it up and you look at the pictures of it, you'll see that it's, you know, the two faces are together because they're kissing. So there's really no true way to really identify them by any kind of features. So I thought that was kind of an interesting one. The next person, who we do not know who they are, is Agent 355. And Agent 355 was this female spy during the American Revolution who worked as a part of the Culper Ring, which, if you don't know what the Culper Ring is, it was actually this spy ring that was formed at the order of George Washington to try to glean as much information as possible about the British. Obviously, that was in his best interest because we were at war with Britain at the time, and George Washington asked a man named Major Benjamin Talmadge to create this organization, this spy ring. And there's actually a popular TV show on AMC called Turn that is about Washington's spies, his spy ring, and that's what the Culper Ring was. I mean, this was this, you know, covert organization. It's probably the first instance of a CIA type spy organization in history in this country, and which is America, just to clarify. And, you know, the United States, they had a deep need to gain as much leverage as they possibly could against the British because they were just this massive empire. And, you know, people who know the history of the Revolutionary War and obviously how America was born and came to win its independence, you know, it was a lot of actually, you know, not necessarily war acts that really kind of sealed the deal there. Like, a lot of it had to do with the spies, the spy network that George Washington had, you know, ordered be created was integral in kind of sealing the deal, per se, in terms of being able to gain a leg up on the enemy. And, you know, it was a very successful network. I mean, that's like one of the big reasons why George Washington could be ahead of the British Army, you know, and have his armies be one step ahead when possible. But Agent 355, she's one of the most, you know, I guess, she was a very mythical figure, you know. So she's the one that's remembered well, but nobody knows her actual identity, you know. And it's said that her number, the 355, was something that was decrypted from the system that the Culper Ring had used, and actually meant lady, was translated. And Agent 355 was, you know, instrumental in a lot of passing a lot of information to George Washington to help, you know, with the war efforts. So it's kind of interesting, and you know, she's interesting. And, you know, in that same note, there was a lot of spies, and I'm sure don't get a lot of credit. That AMC show follows Abe Woodhull, who was a spy who was kind of torn between being a Tory or a British loyalist and wanting independence, and kind of, you know, that the show kind of follows how he, you know, he had to struggle to toe the line there to find his place, I guess, you know, find his identity in a sense. If I could throw in a plug for the name of the show, but, you know, find out what he wanted to be in terms of leaving his mark on history, you know, and that was something that you have to imagine was really tough in that time frame, you know, And you think throughout history, all the times when people had to make those tough choices and decide which side they were on, you know, that's one of those examples, because it's, you know, it's never clear at the time. Like, I'm sure he was nervous. Like, he thought, like, well, what if I am a spy? And what if I get caught? Obviously, I'll be executed. Or what if I picked the wrong side? What if, you know, the British weren't so bad? You know, like, he maybe had these thoughts, and that could have easily been the wrong decision. But he believed in what was going on, and he kind of stuck to his guns, you know. And Agent 5355 was also in that same group who believed in the new America concept, you know, and supported it wholeheartedly. So that made for, you know, an interesting story and an interesting tale. And it's pretty amazing that it was kept such with such secrecy that her true identity was never exposed. So that's just kind of another interesting unknown person in history. Another person who actually, you know, had to risk a lot to kind of stand up for their beliefs was an unknown person that goes by the name Tank Man, who was famously pictured in the Tiananmen Square massacre photograph, where he's standing in the middle of the road and there's four tanks, but they're lined up and stopped, and he's just kind of standing there. And it's an impactful moment, and there's kind of speculation as to who he might have been, but there's nothing that's ever been, you know, set in the record straight about his true identity. And then there's speculation that he was immediately taken away and killed. There's other, you know, evidence that he actually was able to walk away, that the tanks didn't fire on him because they, you know, I don't know if he was an old wise man looking guy or something, but he maybe looked like he was to be respected. And so he didn't budge, and they didn't budge. And then eventually he kind of walked on, and he made his point, and he made a big impact in history, you know. And he was standing up for the right to have democracy, you know, in China. So that's what the Tiananmen Square incident was. And, you know, interestingly, the Chinese government, I believe, still does this. They block searches. I think that was a big controversy with Google going into China. I don't know if they ever actually fully went in there, but there was, you know, all this debate because the Chinese government didn't want to allow their citizens to search Tiananmen Square in the massacre, because, you know, they didn't want it to ever happen again and have these protests erupt. But there was a lot of people who, you know, were pro-democracy supporters who were involved in that protest. And it was unfortunate that it turned out to, you know, end very badly with a lot of, you know, unnecessary deaths. But this man, the Tank Man, was famous for standing in front of these tanks and not being known who he was. And it was more of a snapshot in history of a person that was, you know, standing up for their beliefs. Now, I think there's obviously some of the lighter ones where we can assume that those people, you know, lived happy, healthy lives after their famous incidents. But there are some where, you know, this is a sad case, because this next one is, you know, the shadows that were left behind after the Hiroshima bomb went off. So for those who don't know, and at the, you know, the end of World War II, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima in Japan, and also in Nagasaki, and they killed a lot of people. It was a huge bomb. It was a devastating bomb. It destroyed a city. It literally, you know, caused human beings to just disintegrate because the heat and the energy was so strong. And what kind of leads to this shadow person or people was the fact that there were these shadows left behind. So after the dust settled from the bomb, people, you know, went out and they looked around, and it had to have been an immense amount to try to digest after seeing that. But they would go out and somebody found and photographed these shadows that were left imprinted on the steps. And it was a shadow that was essentially burnt in to the steps from the shadow of a person. Like it's hard to explain, like, but you'd have to actually look it up to see it. And I'll tell you, I would warn you, you know, it could be a little disturbing to some people, but you know, it was just the fact that the heat was so immense that it left this shadow, burnt shadow, like black splotch or whatever, in the shape of a person, and also, you know, what looked like the shape of a cane. So for, you know, for one of them, where it just looked like, you know, the person had just been caused to disappear in a sense, as if they were just walking up the steps with a cane, and then this bomb went off and it happened so fast, you know, they obviously couldn't get cover or anything like that, but all that was left behind was a shadow. And so that's just kind of nuts, like, to me, to think about, like, that there's some kind of massive energy out there so strong that humans possess that ability to unleash it on other humans, and that it could do that kind of thing. You know, it could, you know, be so intense that it doesn't leave the trace of any kind of person. It just leaves, you know, this shadow of a person. So that is just, you know, I think something that you gotta kind of stop and think. And, you know, not to be preachy about peace, but peace seems a lot better than being left as a shadow. You know, quote that and put it on a t-shirt. So that's another instance, because there's no way to ever know the identity of that person. So that's somebody, you know, who's gone and can only be remembered by this little bit of evidence that this person ever existed. So that's kind of heavy. Now, there's some mystery behind why people think it's fascinating or have this desire to venture out in sub-zero degree weather with just, you know, spending an exorbitant amount of money, carrying crazy expensive gear, and risking their lives, where they have probably a really high probability of dying, to climb Mount Everest. So, you know, that alone is a mystery. Why would people think that was a good idea? I think obviously it's humans' adventurous spirit, and it's something that I don't think I've ever had any kind of desire to do. Now, I do like hiking, and I do like summiting like reasonably high cliffs or mountains, but you know, I'm kind of realistic. And as I told you in my camping story in the previous episode, where, you know, I ventured out with a 50-pound pack just to hike for a couple hours, and it nearly killed me. I can only imagine how quickly I would die on Everest trying to hike up that. But needless to say, in recent times, actually in 2017, there were four hikers that were found. Their bodies were found, they were dead in a tent, and they were unable to identify them. And the crazy thing about this, because I you know, this popped up when I was just kind of digging into some of stories, doing a little research on, you know, unidentified bodies and things that kind of come up in the news. And this popped up when I was doing the search. And, you know, what's really crazy about this is there's a lot of bodies on Everest. And, you know, that kind of blew my mind a couple of years ago when I started seeing these stories, and then I started actually doing research, and then I ended up watching YouTube videos and looking at pictures, and you know how you sometimes go down a rabbit hole of discovery and you just start unveiling things that you just never could even imagine. And it's like, you know, they say looking at a train wreck, you just can't look away. But it's insane because there's a ton of bodies that are basically just frozen in place, and it's too dangerous to actually extract them. Either they're frozen to the ground, so they physically have no way of removing the bodies, or it would just be too dangerous to extract the bodies. But there's a ton of bodies left up on Everest. And you know, parenthetically, there's a bunch of trash too, which is in you know, human waste, which is kind of nasty, that's frozen. But the bodies is a little disturbing because, you know, they're actually used as trail markers. Like, I've seen a couple things that say, you know, one of the most famous bodies is nicknamed Green Boots. I guess the person had green boots. They did eventually identify this person, but he's a trail marker because his feet are kind of obstructing the trail slightly, and there was an overhang, and it's kind of sad because this guy was essentially just hugging himself to try to stay warm and had covered his face to try to prevent, you know, further cold on his face. And, you know, people say he looks like he's taking a nap, but he probably was just freezing. And there's all types of things that have happened with avalanches or blizzards come in, or, you know, you run out of oxygen, and a lot of the deaths have happened because of that. And it's just insane to think, you know, that people continue to go up this mountain to summit Everest. But, you know, what are you thinking when you have to step over a dead body? Like, that's just kind of bizarre and twisted to me, but that's just me. And, you know, another instance that I can tell a story of this, you know, the unidentified, the unknown identities of people. And that's unfortunately some travelers that went up Everest. And it's kind of crazy because, you know, from what I've read, just because, like I said, I went down a rabbit hole looking up Everest, that, you know, it's like 10, 11 grand for a permit. And the Nepalese government just issues permits just because they just want that money. They just keep collecting that, you know, 10, 11 grand. And there's only a small, like a short window that you can actually climb Everest, and it's in the spring, and it's somewhere in May, I think, and I think it's only 3 or 4 weeks, and that's the only window that you can actually do it. And it's just, it's a nightmare. Like, this 2019 season, I guess there were traffic jams, and like, apparently, you know, that is very dangerous, but apparently that was causing a lot of concern, because, you know, the concern is obviously when you have a backlog of people trying to summit and you can't go forwards or backwards, you know, people essentially die and they just could just fall off. Just, you know, you got a thin trail and you get disoriented or something, and you just fall off the side of the mountain and you're gone, and then that's it. And that's kind of nuts. There's a movie, I think, called Everest, that was about, you know, one of the tragic days on the mountain when, you know, something like, I don't know how many people, was 10 to 15 people died in this, because this storm kind of came in somewhat unexpectedly, or you know, a lot of like the movie kind of paints it as just error in judgment, but these people, you know, went up to summit and they just kind of stayed a little bit too long, or they just went up too late and they didn't have enough oxygen with them, and the timing was off and the storm rolled in, and you know, it's based on a true story, and like one of the guys, you know, he ended up like losing his like fingers and toes or something like that, but his wife was, you know, very vigilant and diligent, and you know, she kind of got a heads up that he was trapped up there, and then she did everything she could, and she managed to charter a helicopter from like some crazy pilot who basically was willing to go fly up there to rescue this guy. So that guy ended up getting rescued, but you know, he ended up suffering the consequences because he ended up losing like his fingers and toes. So that's kind of a sad ending to that. But needless to say, that's just, you know, people take their lives in their hands. And then what's the result? You know, what's kind of crazy about the four people that are unknown is they didn't have any kind of records of it. So you got to wonder, like, how did this happen? But then you think, well, it's so overcrowded up there. Like, maybe they just found a way. Maybe they were able to bribe the right people, but they basically snuck their way up there, but didn't have the proper gear and perished. So that's sad. But another story of unidentified people that probably will remain in history, at least the history of climbing Everest. And, you know, I've shared that now forward with you. And you can go tell your friends not to climb Everest, and this is why. But it's interesting. Like, these are just kind of, you know, small examples of people that essentially left a impact in some way on the world. I think it's always, you know, from my perspective, it's always something in human nature to try to leave some kind of impact in life and leave something behind, you know? I mean, I think people have been doing it for millions of years or thousands of years. Maybe not millions. Yeah. Millions would be like maybe the aliens that were secretly leaving messages. I don't believe that's true, but let's say thousands of years, because thousands of years ago there were cave paintings, and that was people leaving their mark. Now, that was the only form of writing that they could pass along to their, you know, what they could imagine as their next generation of children and relatives. But, you know, that's how they kind of tried to live on. But you don't know the identities of the people who created those cave paintings necessarily. You don't know that it was, you know, I don't even know. What would a cave person's name be? I'll say Grug, because I love The Croods. I thought that was a great movie. You know, but nobody knows Grug Anderson was the one who actually painted the, you know, the giant saber-toothed cat attacking his family, you know, and you can't trace it back. He didn't exactly, you know, sign it like GA at the bottom. So there's tons and tons of examples throughout history of people who essentially did things without expecting any kind of recognition for it, and, you know, left an impact or made an impact on future generations. You know, I love the idea of authors, you know, writing books that essentially are imprinting in history in a sense, because they're forever going to be in history, you know, if at least if you've got a couple copies out there, you know, but you publish a book out and it gets distributed in any form, even if you self-published it and you just handed it out to your family members, like it could live on for however long, you know, that it stays alive. And it you know, and I say stay alive, you know, hopefully doesn't burn up in some kind of fire or something like that, but gets passed along. You know, I mean, I've got little books that my grandmother had given me, and along with other books, but you know, I've actually had a ton of old books that my grandfather had that I just took when he passed away, you know, because I thought it always would let me remember him, but it's, in a sense, that author wrote that book, and it's a legacy that's kind of being carried forward because people are going to remember that author. You know, someone in the future might come along and pick up that book and then start reading it and learn something from that author that they never expected. You know, I have to wonder, you know, with podcasts, like what's the archive for that going to be? Obviously it needs to be digital, but you can't exactly just go and easily play this back. I mean, now you can, obviously, with the internet and all this technology, but if that stuff were to up and vanish, it's kind of vanished with it. You know, it's like this whole recording is just going to kind of up and disappear. That's kind of a heavy thought to think about, you know, and I don't want to think about it. It's too heavy. Makes me feel like I'm wasting my time, but I don't feel like I am, because who knows, you know? Like, maybe aliens, like, don't even need the power, or, you know, or future generations. I keep saying aliens, like, they, I have mixed feelings about aliens. They're unidentified, and this episode was about unidentified peoples, but mostly this podcast is about finding our identity, so I don't want to talk about unidentified things like aliens, but I digress, and I think this was kind of a lighter episode that I wanted to put out there. You know, I think the one in recent memory, there's one last identified person that there's a picture that's burned into my memory that a lot of people around my age, or, you know, people who lived through 9/11 would remember, you know, on the front page of newspapers as a still photo on video broadcasts. But, you know, the unknown man that was jumping or falling, but he's in midair, and the backdrop is one of the Twin Towers, and he's falling, and you have no idea who this person is, but somebody happened to capture that picture at just the right moment. Although those towers are so tall, you know, you could have seen that man falling and then had the time to take out your camera and take the picture and still capture him falling, because that's the kind of height and the amount of time it would take to fall from those buildings. But, you know, his peaceful pose as he's dropping is kind of impactful, because he's not flailing his arms. He's just falling with, looks like his arms are at his side and his legs are just kind of out straight or almost limp in a sense, you know, but rigid enough where it doesn't look like he's kicking. And it's kind of a powerful memory of that day, you know, where he kind of just feels like he resigned himself to falling because he felt that was it. That was all he could do at that point. You know, I would hope to think that, you know, possibly like he was dead before he fell, and that's just how he started falling, and you know, wasn't flipping around or tumbling or anything like that, but potentially like was knocked out by the blast of, you know, the airplane that exploding on this floor that he was on. But we'll never know. And there's no way to ever know who that person is. You know, I think people have or agencies or archivists or researchers or whatever have tried to identify the person, and there's speculation that he might have been a maintenance worker, maybe based on what they see him wearing in it. But if you look up the falling man from 9/11, you'd see the picture, and it's sad, but I think it's a powerful picture. And that's the last unknown person that I'm talking about in this podcast. And I guess ending on kind of a sad note in a sense, but, you know, I think we can learn a lot from history. Obviously it's usually used as a teacher, as a educational marker. Like, you look back and you think of what past generations have made as mistakes, and you try to learn from those mistakes. And, you know, you look at, they say, you know, history repeats itself, you know, and I think if you look throughout history at the way wars happen and the way that financial markets crash and the way things just kind of fluctuate in our society, it's one of those things that, you know, you can kind of learn. Like, you look at the mistakes that have happened, maybe even just in your immediate lives, like watching your parents or something like that, you know, or your grandparents, and you can pick up and learn from their mistakes, you know, or at least that's what the hope is. Although, you know, you tend to be like, I'm a teenager and, or whatever, and I'm smarter than the previous generation, and you think you're going to do better. And then you get in your 20s thinking you're smarter than everybody and you're going to do better, and you don't listen. And then you get in your 30s and you're like, man, I really should have listened. But people are going to learn their lessons the way they learn their lessons. But I think it's a good teacher of whatever, you know, has come before us. Like, it's a good teacher for what to do in the future. I mean, it's obviously like a lot of educational techniques are built off of, you know, kind of learning the patterns or finding out ways to do something. And, you know, even like you look at, like I'm a developer and like having to write code and whatnot, you know, things continue to kind of evolve and new technologies form, but there's still some underlying commonality between it that you can learn from. So I just kind of randomly went off the rails there, and you're just watching because you love to watch train wrecks. Like I said, it's just fascinating. Can't look away. So that, I think, is going to be the end of this episode, because I don't have anything else to say. And I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Finding Your Identity. And I look forward to hearing you listen. No, I look forward to anticipating that you're listening next time. Something like that. I look forward to making the next episode. I always do. Just because I hope it benefits somebody somewhere. At some point, I know it's not benefiting the NLs. You know, and I told you, I haven't talked about them because of the lawsuit, but, you know, those non-listeners, and I don't even care what my lawyer tells me, but those non-listeners, they have a fight coming. They started to rebel. They formed a little army, but my army's bigger. And, you know, it's going to be kind of like a Walking Dead showdown. There's like a Negan-type dude, except he's got a wiffle ball bat and silly string wrap in it, but he's wearing a leather jacket. So, you know, those non-listeners, they got a reckoning coming. Until next time, this is Finding Your Identity. I enjoy telling random stories. It's fun. So I'm gonna tell you another story right now. I hope you enjoy. So, this isn't a story per se, but maybe it could be classified more as a PSA. But I want to talk about zipper merges just because it's a frustrating thing for me. Like, I hate when I'm driving and people aren't following the zipper merge etiquette. And this may seem like a senseless rant, but I think it's important to educate people on what the heck the zipper merge is and why you're supposed to do it. Now, for those of you who are like, okay, I think this is the point that we can pinpoint in time when Derek has lost his mind and gone nuts. And now he's just talking about any random nonsense. But this isn't random nonsense, because if you really think about it, driving can be dangerous. And if you don't know how to do it properly, then you could hurt others. So this is a PSA, because I'm trying to save lives. And I'm trying to be serious about this, but it is kind of silly because it's a silly thing to have a pet peeve about. But anyways, a zipper merge. It's basically an engineering method that when you have two lanes that have cars going in the same direction and it goes down to one lane, at the point in which it goes down to one lane, the cars that are, you know, basically in the lane that is no longer open are supposed to merge into in between the cars that are in the lane that is open, and they're supposed to just alternate. And people, I think, feel that it's a slight at them to merge in front of them, and they feel like they're being cut off. And they feel like, and I could understand this, how you feel like, well, I was the one who was patient and who sat in line and waited, you know, properly, and I didn't actually cut in front of anybody, and I didn't actually, you know, step in on anyone's toes or cut in line, and I really was following the proper etiquette and staying in my lane. But in reality, the quickest way to move traffic from two lanes to one lane, according to research, is for cars to, you know, slow down to the appropriate speed, which I want to say is probably between, you know, 25 and 30 miles an hour, maybe 35, 40, I guess, depending if you're on a highway or not, but, you know, on the back road or, you know, on non-highway roads, it's probably 25, 30 miles an hour, but you slow down to that speed. And if everybody's doing it properly, then the traffic should actually not slow down that much. It still should be able to continue at a decent pace. But when you have people who won't let other people in, and when there's or people who cut in and then cause, you know, like cut in people who cut in somewhat unexpectedly or unsafely and cause the person that they're cutting in front of to have to slam on their brakes and then create that chain reaction of everybody slamming on their brakes going backwards, that throws off the whole rhythm of the zipper merge. And so I think people need to be aware of when you come up, when you're going from two lanes to one lane, you need to follow the zipper merge protocol, which is to alternate, you know, and you shouldn't be the person who's trying to edge in, who's on the left, who, you know, is trying to bypass letting the next person in on the right side merge in properly. So that is my two cents about zipper merges and my PSA to try to educate people into doing them properly. And it's just a funny word to say, zipper merge. You know, I would have thought that it was, you know, a bad term or something like that, like when something gets stuck in your zipper. I'm not going to say what, because I don't want to cringe. And it was a bad zipper merge, but it's not. It has to do with traffic. So there's that. And you'll often, you know, if you start looking up zipper merge on the internet, you're going to see arguments for both sides. But, you know, research shows they're good. So that's that. And I just wanted to get that off my chest. And now I feel a lot better. And I feel like I'll be calmer in knowing that other people are probably going to listen to this and then start following zipper merge protocol. So thank you very much.